It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, just 24 days before the Iowa caucuses, and Ted Cruz continues to hold a small advantage over Donald Trump here in Iowa. Well, that's according to polling aggregator Real Clear Politics. And this week, the Texas senator, Cruz, was on a six-day, 28-county tour of our state. He's hoping, of course, to solidify his lead in the polls less than a month ahead of those February 1st caucuses. Hundreds of voters turning out at the venues in small towns across Iowa to see Ted Cruz. Joyce Russell followed him on Monday when he was at four different venues. She's with us now, Iowa Public Radio correspondent. Hi, Joyce.
Hello, Ben.
Where did you catch up with Ted Cruz?
Well, he started the tour in Boone, went from Boone to Carroll, then to Guthrie Center, and ended at the end of the day on Winterset, or at least I ended the day with him on Winterset. He drove on to Missouri Valley, where he had people turn out to see him at 10:30 at night.
Mm-hmm. So what are the, is he drawing people?
Well, yeah, all the venues are small, so it's standing room only, which, you know, creates the feeling that there's lots of people there, but there were at least 100 people at each of these, maybe as many as 200 by the time that he got to Winterset.
Mm-hmm.
And those aren't huge numbers, but he's doing the right thing by going to all these places.
Mm-hmm. Any specific venues that match up with his message? Or, of course, he's backed by many Iowa evangelicals.
Well, and his first stop was at a Christian bookstore in Boone. Then at his last stop in Winterset, he was at the Winterset stage, and he was accompanied by evangelical leaders, Bob Vanderplatz, the head of the family leader, and the very well-known radio personality, James Dobson. They were both with him in Winterset.
I understand him also on this tour, at least for part of it, 4th District GOP Congressman Steve King. What role is he playing?
Well, he has endorsed Senator Cruz. And he pointed out, he spoke at each of these venues, and he pointed out that the last two elections, he did not endorse a candidate, so he's choosy about who he endorses, but they are like-minded conservatives, especially hardline on immigration, both of them.
Mm-hmm. And I understand Cruz was bragging a bit about how he and Congressman King are not well-liked on Capitol Hill.
That's right. Senator Cruz has been called the most unpopular member of the Iowa Senate. And when Representative King endorsed him, people made the comment, or somebody tweeted the comment, that the one of the least well-liked members of the Iowa House has now endorsed the least liked member of the Iowa Senate. They're very contentious personalities in the Congress.
And Cruz made light of that. Let's listen to that little clip.
You know, you and I are sitting right now in our campaign bus. Next to us is Iowa's own Congressman Steve King. And I'll tell you, Steve and I are both despised by the Washington cartel. I've joked that both of us need food tasters in the members' dining room.
Okay, so Cruz is out there, at least on Monday, out there in the west and west central part of the state, Congressman King's territory, you could say. Is he going to other places, or really capitalizing or focusing on the areas of the state that do have a lot of his backers?
Oh, no, he's all over. He'll make it to all the way up into northeast Iowa by the end of the tour on Saturday. He just started in the west, and I don't know whether Congressman King is going to accompany him all the way. He was, you know, very much in King's territory on Monday.
Mm-hmm. His main rival in the GOP primary, at least according to polls, is Donald Trump, running neck and neck with Donald Trump here in Iowa. Donald Trump, of course, another candidate well outside the establishment GOP. You've been to Donald Trump rallies here in Iowa. How do they compare with Ted Cruz rallies?
Well, Trump is in big venues with, you know, much larger crowds. Trump doesn't take the evangelical approach, and that was a part of Cruz's message at each of these venues, starting with the Christian bookstore and ending with the evangelical leaders in Winterset. But at every stop, he recited a verse from the Bible and said, pray for my campaign. So that's one big difference. But, you know, the venues, Trump is in the big auditoriums. You know, the first time he went was in a high school gymnasium, I think, or rather a high school auditorium in Oskaloosa, and it wasn't nearly big enough. And so, you know, like Veterans Auditorium in Cedar Rapids, those kinds of venues. But the thing that Cruz is doing right is by going into all of these small places. It's a matter of organization, getting down in, you know, to the grassroots with people, and just across the board, people are praising him for his organizational effort, and going to all these small places is part of that.
When you've talked to Ted Cruz backers at these rallies, the several you were at on Monday, give us a sense of their main concerns. What's driving them? What will drive them to support a candidate on caucus day? Ted Cruz, perhaps.
Well, almost without exception, the people that I talked to talked about the Constitution, and that they feel like the country has gotten away from the founding fathers. Cruz is very big on that issue. They also agree with the immigration stance. And then the religious thing is not a small thing. Senator Cruz said at one of the events that only 25% of evangelical voters voted in the last election. And that was kind of surprising to me because we hear about how influential they are. But they're not as influential as they might be. And that he said that at almost every stop. It's very important that evangelicals come out. But actually, of all the people that I talked to, they were more interested in immigration and guns and that kind of thing than the religious angle.
Mm, interesting. Joyce Russell, thanks for telling us a little bit about your day spent with the Ted Cruz campaign in four different stops on Monday as Ted Cruz tries to solidify a small lead he seems to have in the polls in Iowa, less than a month ahead of the February 1st caucuses. Joyce Russell, Iowa Public Radio correspondent, thanks for the update.
Thank you, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. How's Iowa competitiveness when it comes to business? That's a key question behind the annual Iowa Competitiveness Index, and that's issued by the Iowa Business Council. A new report has just come out, so let's talk with Elliot Smith. He's executive director of the Iowa Business Council. Hi, Elliot.
Hi, Ben.
So this is an annual index, just to get us up to speed on it. It measures the state's competitiveness in five key issue areas. What are those?
We look every year at various data and information under economic growth, under education and workforce readiness, governance and fiscal matters, health and well-being, and then demographics and diversity.
So what does the new report say? How are we doing?
Well, this is the sixth time we've put the report out, and on a very high level, just for the five issue areas themselves, not a lot of overall change. We have a scoring system of green, yellow, and red where we assign, you know, are things really going well? It's green, yellow, well, things haven't changed much from the last year, or red, you know, we really need to pay attention to this. And on a big level, everything's still sort of maintained since 2015. Underneath each issue area, though, we track a number of data points and information regarding this competitiveness issue, and there has been some change, some move in the labor force participation rate here in Iowa. We're doing really well. Things like median household income continues to maintain a good spot, though it could be better. So, overall, I think things are good for the state in the coming year.
Mm-hmm. When you say they're put into green, yellow, or red, any areas that are in red that we continue to need to look at?
You bet. I would highlight one under economic growth, and that pertains to what we call knowledge jobs. Those are jobs where you need to excel in education or go beyond simply a high school diploma to receive either a two-year education at a community college, or going to a four-year school, get a bachelor's degree, or even go into the trades and receive some sort of certification or licensure. The knowledge jobs tend to pay more, tend to have more benefits attached to them. Just in general, elevate a person's income and improves the state's per capita income. So that measure, since we first started tracking it, has fallen quite a bit. We were ranked 18th. Back in our base year. Now, as of this index, we're 31st.
So we've been dropping when compared to other states, but are our elected officials taking up the slack here, trying to up our knowledge jobs somehow?
Well, I think they have been very focused on this issue. You have seen some companies such as Facebook and IBM and Microsoft bring operations to the state, and so we've sort of broken the bread on initially on some of these companies. The number of those jobs could be better, and that's what we're focused on. And it's a matter, and it's also, you know, business needs to step up and continue to develop those sorts of career opportunities that lend themselves to additional education, more certification, kind of a lifelong learning situation. So it is one area of focus we felt important to point out this year.
We often hear, Elliot, about how Des Moines is listed as a top place to move for millennials or mm-hmm. most wealthy city to live in. How does that square with what your index found?
Well, you know, we do see that for a number of urban centers around the state, really. Des Moines gets some recognition. You'll see it every so often for Cedar Rapids and Iowa City and Ames and maybe Dubuque and other larger cities. Our focus is statewide, though. This isn't just a Des Moines index or a big city index. We have operations statewide in all 99 counties. Our chair currently is in Lamar's with the Wells Enterprises, you know, Blue Bunny folks. So very sensitive to what we can do to try and, you know, elevate the competitive posture of small, medium, and large-sized companies wherever they may be in the state. And so things like knowledge jobs, certainly important in Des Moines, just as important in Lamar's.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about the difference between rural jobs, rural competitiveness compared to urban?
Well, you have some unique challenges, I think, in the urban setting. Different things appeal to different people and different job prospects. So, salary and benefits become an issue sometimes on the competitive side for those sorts of positions. It's a quality of life issue, too, sometimes. People are looking to remove themselves from the larger population centers. Certainly, we have a number of great economic development organizations around the state that do focus on rural counties or rural regions of the state, doing their best to step up and show what's good about living in a town of 10,000 or 5,000 people.
We all know, Elliot, that Iowa is well known for raising great kids and educating those great kids to be intelligent great kids and then young adults to, but then we also hear they like to leave the state. Are we doing any better with keeping the young talented people within our borders?
Well, that is another area, folks. In fact, you mentioned schools. That's one area where the rural segment often does compete very well with very strong pre-K through 12 facilities and school systems. But in terms of, you know, attracting kids to come to Iowa to go to school, to stay here and go to school, and then bringing others from out of state, I think we're fairly successful. Iowa State has seen record enrollment. Iowa is close to record enrollment levels. That challenge with those folks is trying to provide maybe some internship opportunities while they're here in school to introduce them to the state's business climate and business opportunities, career opportunities. It's hard to fight the wanderlust, feeling some kids have when they get out of school, especially if they're born and raised here in Iowa. But retaining those graduates that we've spent a lot of time educating is a focal point. I will admit that.
Mm-hmm. You've mentioned that you've been doing this index for 6 years. Mm-hmm. Have you had an impact? And tell us, how do you hope this report will be used?
Well, I think we've seen a little progress in things such as under education and workforce readiness. We've been focused on proficiency levels, and in our index, 8th grade reading and math, but there's also 4th grade assessments, and later on in high school, we've really honed in on what we need to make sure kids are prepared when they come out of high school, and we've seen new curriculum offerings and standards put in place in the state, along with new assessments now, which help us gauge the competency level of kids. So we've seen a little progress there. To take credit for it might not be appropriate, but I think we've urged or helped the conversation along amongst, say, Department of Education officials and education leaders around the state.
Elliot Smith, thank you very much for this update. Executive Director of the Iowa Business Council talking about the annual Iowa Competitiveness Index, the newest just issued. Elliot, thank you so much.
You bet. Thank you, Ben. Appreciate the opportunity.
It's a Friday News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This week, Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump released his first television ad here in Iowa, also in New Hampshire. In it, he touts himself as America's savior against radical Islamic terrorism, in his words. A leading Iowa imam is now responding to Trump's rhetoric, not only in that ad, but, as we know, additional rhetoric, with an invitation. I'm joined now by Imam Taha Tawil, imam and director of the Mother Mosque of America in Cedar Rapids. Imam Taha Tawil, welcome to our program.
Thank you for having me.
What is your invitation for Donald Trump? Tell us what you communicate.
Well, we want him to know that we are American citizens like him, and we want him to come and talk to his fellow American citizens and explain to them what his agenda, what his program, and how we can be of help to him. So we are having a friendly invitation, a positive one, as Americans, and that's the way we solve our problems, if we have any, by talking, by sitting together, by having face-to-face conversation. Why this animosity? Why he is carrying that banner of hostility and going around spreading fires here and there in our community?
Mm-hmm. What do you want to tell him in regards to his rhetoric that Muslims should be barred from entering the United States?
Well, simply we want to explain to him how Muslims in America is part of its fabric, it's part of its progress, it's part of its development, and they are part of Iowa, part of United States of America.
Indeed. Explain, go into that. It's ironic that here in Iowa, where these ads are being put out, that Donald Trump is pushing this anti-Muslim fervor to increase his presidential appeal, but this is precisely the state in which you lead the Mother Mosque of America in Cedar Rapids, the oldest surviving mosque, not only in the United States, but also in North America. Tell us a little bit more about the Muslim community here, which dates back farther than many of us really know.
You are right. This is, Iowa is the home of the Mother Mosque, and we have so many senators, congressmen, and leaders in the government, governors, and many, many have been proud of our existence, have been supportive in our existence. The community goes way back to the late 1800s, and they worked in hand in hand with the community at large. They have been in every aspect, business people, doctors, lawyers. They have been in any field, in the army, in the Marines, in the Navy, all over. The Muslim community is like any other community. It's like the Dutch, it's like the Irish, it's like the Greeks, it's like every other community. And so Mr. Donald Trump, with our respect, he has, I don't know, resources or advisors around him that feeding him wrong information. That's why we are, as Americans, we invite him to come, and we will talk to him privately or publicly, and we will invite the Muslims from the state of Iowa to talk to him and to tell him about our concerns.
Have you had any reaction from the Trump campaign to your invitation?
Well, some of his followers start emailing bad emails, and that is a shame. That's a very shame to see such rhetoric, even with this, you know, campaign. And I am telling you, our women are scared. They are fearing to get out to the public. Our children in the school are harassed. And we are like the Jewish community during Germany time. We are like fearing like the black community in the 30s and 40s. We are like the other minorities, the Japanese. We are right now almost under siege with his rhetoric and his banner and radical Islam. We are against radical Islam. We want him to know that those radicals are killing more Muslims than anybody else. And that's why we as a team, we as Americans, we can work together to solve this issue and help him out instead of creating division and creating fear and terrorizing the American community. That's wrong.
So in your group, your congregation there at the Mother Mosque in Cedar Rapids, you share your people, your fellow Muslims, share instances where you've been harassed and perhaps verbally abused or otherwise abused?
Indeed, the media, the Twitter, the Facebook, the internet, it's full. It's full of incidents. Someone throw bigs, head of bigs around, vandalize Islamic centers, burning mosques. We heard, we see. But thank God, not in Iowa.
Mm-hmm.
So far, Iowa have been very hospitable. Iowa always have been very inclusive.
Have you had any reaction from the Trump campaign itself that you can verify is from the Trump campaign?
No, we did not hear from them. We did not talk to them yet. And we are planning to have a written invitation in writing with a registered letter to be directly, personally to Mr. Donald Trump.
Okay, thank you very much. We will certainly want to check back with you about any response that the Trump campaign may have to your invitation. Imam Taha Tawil, Imam and Director of the Mother Mosque of America in Cedar Rapids, thank you very much for this conversation.
Thank you, Mr. Van Kiever. God bless you and bless America.
Coming up after a short break, this week President Obama announced executive actions aimed at reducing gun violence. We'll ask how those actions may change gun laws here in Iowa. Also, the dangers of cold water when our lakes and streams aren't quite frozen, and the Iowa Music Project's songwriting showcase. That's all coming up after a quick break. It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Earlier this week, President Obama announced some modest new restrictions on gun sales across the country. The centerpiece of his executive actions was the issuing of a guidance document on which gun sales require a federal firearms license. So, brings to mind the question, how will these new actions change gun laws in Iowa, if at all? Ross Loader is with us. He's Bureau Chief responsible for the Weapons Permit Section at the Iowa Department of Safety. Ross, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Ben.
So what can you tell us about the president's new actions, about what they will change or have already changed?
Well, some of the president's proposals have really very little impact in Iowa. There is one proposal to address the creation of fairly complicated legal instruments, specifically trusts, that people are using in some states to more easily acquire and trade fully automatic firearms, short-barreled rifles, short-barreled shotguns, and silencers. Those items are generally prohibited for a private citizen to possess in Iowa. So that change, while it's interesting to many, is not one that we would expect to have any significant impact in Iowa. Perhaps the one of the other features that the president has announced is a proposal really calling and asking states to take steps to improve the completeness, accuracy, and thoroughness of criminal history and mental health records, Iowa's already a leader of the pack when it comes to the thoroughness and completeness of our records. We actually were recently visited by the FBI, which was hoping to visit some of the best performing states to help develop best practice recommendations that could be made available to those jurisdictions that don't perform as well when it comes to thorough and complete records and availability for background check purposes. We also have a very significant undertaking that's been completed to provide certain mental health related firearm prohibitions to the background check system. Mm-hmm. So some of those efforts to enhance our capabilities in the background check realm are items where I was already a leader of the pack.
Mm-hmm. What about the types of firearms sold in this country? Are there restrictions on certain weapons and ammunition?
Well, there certainly are. At the federal level, there are really two primary regulatory and statutory provisions that govern the trade and possession of firearms. One is the National Firearms Act of 1934, which deals with what we in Iowa call offensive weapons. That's machine guns, silencers, short-barreled rifles, and things of that sort. And then separately, you have the Gun Control Act of 1968 and subsequent amendments, including the Brady Act amendments. And that, generally speaking, provides a regulatory framework for the licensing of dealers, and it establishes prohibitions that make certain people ineligible to possess a firearm. In Iowa, we have laws addressing both topics, both the offensive weapons, such as fully automatic firearms, which are generally prohibited, and we have other laws that specify who under state law is eligible to possess a firearm.
Mm-hmm. We hear that these actions were aimed also at closing these loopholes, these gun show loopholes. Do they exist in Iowa?
Well, the gun show loophole terminology is really shorthand for describing a fairly complicated situation. And that situation is one in which, under federal law, a dealer is required to be licensed, and a licensed dealer must have a background check performed for each transfer of a firearm. Under federal law, a private party transfer is not subject to the background check requirement. And if a person were to sell a firearm to their neighbor, not only are they not required to have a background check performed, but they cannot access the National Instant Criminal Background Check System, even if they desired to do so. Those are the two ends of the spectrum, a licensed dealer performing checks and a private party selling a gun to a neighbor. The discussion about the gun show loophole is really getting at the issue of the gray area in between the private party and the licensed dealer. At what point does somebody sell frequently enough or sell enough guns that they are no longer just a casual private party selling perhaps to a neighbor and really entering the realm of engaging in the business of buying and selling firearms? The proposals, as we understand them, though details are yet to be released, would provide greater clarity and perhaps make more people subject to federal licensure. But again, those are all federal actions, and they don't directly impact or interact with Iowa law.
Okay, and finally, Ross Loader, as a person at the Iowa Department of Safety responsible for the weapons permit section, has the president's announcement here set off inquiries at your office? Do you have more business because of what the president has been saying?
We're experiencing extremely high volume of inquiries from the public and from the sheriff's offices with which we work, although it's very difficult to discern how much of that significant increase is due to the discussion about gun control legislation and how much is associated with the five-year weapons permit renewal cycle that is currently upon us. Iowa had major changes in weapons law January 1st, 2011. We went to a five-year carry permit. The first 100,000 people issued permits in 2011 are now coming due for renewal in 2016. So we were already expecting very high volume and have, in fact, been experiencing that high volume.
Okay, Ross Loader of the Iowa Department of Safety Bureau Chief, thank you very much.
Thank you, Ben.
It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Quick conversations about news in Iowa this week to round off our week. On Monday morning, Johnson County officials recovered the body of a 17-year-old Iowan from the Coralville Reservoir. This after a capsized canoe sent two people into the icy water last Sunday afternoon. Tanner Weimer, an athletic 17-year-old high school student from Solon, was pronounced dead at the scene. The second canoer survived. On average, there are about 10 drowning deaths per day in the United States. And water, of course, is especially dangerous this time of year when it is freezing or close to freezing. Record temperatures and rainfall this December are making it difficult for us Iowans to enjoy winter activities such as ice fishing or snowmobiling or skating that would normally be common this time of year, as our ice is just not there or not thick enough. It's still forming. Joining me to talk about how our bodies react to extreme cold is Kevin Craigle, professor of human physiology at the University of Iowa. He's also associate provost for faculty at the University of Iowa. Kevin, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Ben.
Each year, over 1,000 deaths in the U.S. are attributed to excessive natural cold. Let's talk about cold water specifically. Why is cold water more dangerous than cold air when you find yourself tipped into it, into a lake or a river here in Iowa, for instance?
Well, there's a couple of really simple explanations. The primary one that is always presented is that the cold water extracts heat from the body at a much greater rate. Some range of 25 to 30 times as much heat gets extracted from the human body. So if you're in a cold water situation, it's quite easy to lose a lot of heat from the body, and obviously that would potentially lead to hypothermia and some other complications. Mm-hmm. The other aspect is clearly the difficulty of moving in cold water, the incapacitation, muscle function declines, nerve conduction declines, and so it's a difficult situation to extract yourself from once you're in the cold water.
Mm-hmm. And of course, if you find yourself suddenly in cold water, fully clothed, you're going to panic. You have you talked about the muscles reacting, and muscles in your chest?
Correct. And one of the first situations that you get into when you're put into cold water is that you have a reflex gasping response, and you do start to panic. And emergency technical folks would recommend that people in those situations try to stay calm and not flail, but try to develop a regular breathing pattern and start being able to move in a coordinated fashion.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about some of the things you can do also if you find yourself in a situation. Let's put it on land when mm-hmm. you get extremely cold. Frostbite can be a danger this time of year. What are some words about cold air as opposed to cold water for us?
Well, cold air exposure leads to really some common sense approaches. The idea of exposed skin losing a lot of heat is clearly a straightforward concept. So you want to cover exposed skin, head and face. Your head loses a lot of heat, certainly. Mm-hmm. The same concept of dampness or moisture on your clothing that would be consistent with what you'd avail yourself to in the water would hold in a land situation where if you've been sweating, exercising, if you're out shoveling snow and you've got damp clothing or it's been raining like it has been the last couple days, you have moisture on your clothing that's going to extract the heat as well. So damp clothing is really a problem in terms of trying to maintain your body temperature at a reasonable level.
Mm-hmm. Why is it that some people can handle cold better than other people? Is that a matter of getting used to it? What do we know about that? What does the science tell us?
Well, that's interesting. The physiology behind cold is quite different than how we cope with heat. The human body does a really nice job of acclimating to heat over a period of time. Cold adaptation is just modest at best with humans. And so most people who cope with the cold well are likely going to be individuals who understand what types of clothing to wear, how to maintain body heat. But It's really not an opportunity for us to be exposed repeatedly over many, many days to weeks and improve to any great extent how we deal with the cold.
Mm-hmm. But what about at the beginning of the year? We have had such a mild December this year. Is there any truth to the fact that, okay, at the early part of the year, the cold temperatures feel colder because you're not used to them and that maybe you just need to get used to it? Maybe, I don't know, around the house if you're feeling chilly, maybe not bundle up as much and give your body the signals to say, hey, get a little thicker skin here.
Well, there's the physiology behind that really doesn't prove out that you would adjust over a period of time, especially over the seasons. I think it would just be more a behavioral approach. And that's where there are some risks involved for individuals, especially older individuals or the very young or people who have certain kinds of health conditions like cardiovascular diseases, diabetes, or on some medications where you don't thermoregulate as well. You aren't going to necessarily adjust when you get exposed to those cold environments as quickly, and those can cause some problems.
Mm-hmm. What about fitness? What does a person's fitness have to do with how they deal with cold and warm?
It's interesting. There are some studies that show some modest improvement in your ability to cope with cold if you're fit. Aerobically trained, for example, but it's not to a great extent. Interestingly, fit individuals aren't going to have as much body fat, for example, and so the insulation of body fat does help in certain situations. For example, in cold water, that's certainly a benefit.
Mm-hmm. As a professor of human physiology, who is well versed in how the body reacts to cold and warm, do you get out in the cold? Do you like to have winter sports as a part of your routine?
Yes, I like to get out in the cold, and fortunately I try to practice what I preach in terms of making sure I'm well covered with clothing and not having a lot of exposed skin. There's other precautions certainly that you would take. The one I did not mention is alcohol, which is clearly contraindicated in a cold weather environment.
It's, right. You feel like, a little drink here,
right?
Would while I'm ice skating or out hiking,
right,
makes me feel warm, but it doesn't actually warm you up.
It does not. Actually, what happens is it's like opening your oven door. That's the analogy I always use. It's allowing really the warm blood from the body core to go to the skin surface. We dilate the skin blood vessels, and a lot of heat escapes. So initially you do feel that flush in the hands and in the face, but what that's doing is allowing more and more of that warm blood to leave the skin and go out to the cold air. So it's really problematic in a cold situation.
Mm-hmm. So if you would find yourself, and if we would get another significant snowfall, trapped in a car on a roadside, a rural roadside in Iowa, and you discover, I didn't really pack all the winter clothing that I should have, don't drink any alcohol if you have that in the car. What could you do if you have little in terms of clothing?
The best options would clearly be to try to cover exposed skin as best you could. Certainly don't drink any alcohol. Caffeine is usually not recommended as well because it can cause dehydration to some extent. And there's two ways we can generate heat. One is primary ways. One is by shivering, and the second is just by fidgeting, moving muscles, and any way that you can contract muscle to try to maintain some heat generation in those kinds of situations would be obviously the best approach.
Okay, Kevin Craigle, thank you very much, professor of human physiology at the University of Iowa. Thanks for coming in and giving some tips about how to deal with the cold and how to avoid the hazards of the cold.
My pleasure. Thank you, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We end our program today with homegrown music and a shout-out to Iowa songwriters. The Iowa Music Project is an endeavor dedicated to supporting live music throughout our state, and the project is now accepting submissions for a statewide songwriting showcase. This is the way it'll work. 25 songs by artists with Iowa ties will be chosen for an Iowa Music Project produced compilation. And honorees will be announced April 1st. You can submit your entries now. In June, then, the Iowa Music Project will stage its launch event at the Des Moines Social Club. It will feature all kinds of homegrown music, and Iowa Public Radio will broadcast that event. Joining me now, Luke Benson, director of the Iowa Music Project in our Iowa City studio. Hi, Luke.
Hey, how you doing?
We are dying to hear more about this songwriting showcase. What are the guidelines? Tell us about it. Any genres?
All genres, yep. That's part of what we're ultimately trying to do is sort of better understand what the Iowa music sound is. We know that part of it's folk music and part of it's rock and roll, but there's a lot of different folks out there making music. And we want to do everything we can to give them sort of a platform to share that kind of music.
So it could be jazz, it could be hip-hop, it could be anything.
Absolutely. Yeah.
It has to be original music, though.
That's it. It has to be original and not published anywhere else previously other than YouTube or SoundCloud.
Mm-hmm. The music doesn't necessarily have to have an Iowa theme about it, right?
Not a bit, no.
Not a bit, okay.
We thought about that at the beginning, but, you know, I mean, really, we don't want to constrain artists. They tend to, you know, dislike that.
Right.
So we thought it'd be better just to have original sounds and let the topics and content, you know, be the artist's choice.
When we say songwriting, are we ruling out songs or musical compositions that wouldn't have lyrics?
Can you have instrumentals here? Yeah, I mean, it's...
We,
for the sake of brevity, we called it Songwriting Showcase. But, you know, it's basically, you know, a song doesn't necessarily have to have the lyrics. It's just, you know, expression through music.
Mm-hmm. So. How do you submit an entry?
Just go to iowamusicproject.com.
Can you put into words the criteria that will be used, or is it, I know it when I hear it. I know good music when I hear it.
Well, so there's a couple different components to it. We're definitely interested in sharing as much of the music as we can with our listeners. And, you know, a big ethic, I guess, or aesthetic going into this project is breaking down the idea of artist and performer on stage and audience member, you mm-hmm. know, so... if there are people out there who are making music in their garage or their bedroom, you know, have no real interest in ever being a live performer, but they're, you know, expressing themselves through music, we'd love to share that on our webpage. You know, we're not trying to select just the best artists who are in the state of Iowa making music, but trying to capture the broad sounds that are being made.
Is this a contest where you will rank them?
No, and that's, you know, I've made a concerted effort to get away from the idea of this being a contest. You know, we're not trying to do Iowa American Idol here in any kind of sense. It's really just an opportunity to showcase and share music that's being made by people that might not otherwise have that avenue to share that sound that they're making.
Luke, tell us more, a little bit more in the couple minutes we have remaining about the Iowa Music Project, its larger goals, its larger mission.
Right. Well, so the ultimate goal of supporting live music is there's a lot of different ways of going about that. From my experience, I grew up in a very musical family, and, you know, the basis of most of my friendships and my partner, like, if it wasn't for music, we wouldn't be together. And so any way that we can do projects that ultimately preserve and support and promote venues and music making in the state, we want to get behind. Our next big fundraising push is going to be to try to get instruments and free music education for low-income students here in Iowa City. I'm also involved with the Dream Center, and we'd like to start up a jazz band and a community choir.
Okay, Luke Benson, we've run out of time. We want to leave a little bit of time for music, the recorded music by a real fine Iowa artist who has made a big name across the country, William Elliott Whitmore from just outside of Keokuk, Iowa. We'll leave with some music. I understand he's going to be part of this launch event.
Right. So the concert will be at the Des Moines Social Club on June 2nd with two openers from the showcase and Middle Western, which is a new supergroup featuring Will Whitmore, Dave Zolo, and a few other artists. It's going to be a great show, and we'd love to see you there.
Okay, Luke Benson, thank you for telling us about the Iowa Music Project and its statewide songwriting showcase, now accepting submissions. So put pen to paper or whatever you do to write a song and get those to the Iowa Music Project. Luke Benson, thank you very much, director of the Iowa Music Project, and we're going to go out with Will Whitmore.
All right.
Well, I was driving down the road just a minding my own when Johnny Law pulled up from behind. He walked up to my window and said, roll it down and let me see what I can find. I said, no way, what's mine is mine. I'd appreciate it if you'd leave me be.
said, I'll leave you be all right in a cell all night. I'll lock you up and throw away the key. He slapped them cuffs on my wrist and my hands clenched into fists. And I wished I could have punched him in the jaw and knocked out old Johnny.
River to River is produced by Claire Roth, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us, and have a great weekend.